Good morning. As we've heard our founder Dogen Zenji say, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So this issue of the self, who we are, has always been an essential teaching of the Buddhas and ancestors as a way to understand how we suffer and how we become free from discontent. The teachings often revolve around this issue of how we understand ourself. So this Parinirvana Sutra is a really good one for exploring all different angles and different, completely contradictory ways of looking at self. So as we talked about last week, I brought up the different versions of self, different types of self, different selves, different definitions of self. And it's good, I think, to be really clear about this. Of course, the sutra doesn't really make these distinctions so clear. And I think that our just tradition of Buddha Dharma often doesn't make it so clear. And Zen especially doesn't make it clear. The word self appears in a lot of Zen texts and just gets thrown out there without talking about which self we mean. So I just think that for myself it's been really helpful to define these different types of self that are kind of different. And then when we use the word self, we can ask ourselves and each other, which one of these are we talking about? And in this class series, we can talk about three types. And the third type of this true self, that's the major type that this sutra is talking about, as another name for Buddha nature. Let's not get into that yet. Let's just keep clarifying these first two types of self that are, I think, taught throughout the Buddha's teaching. So some of you weren't here last week, and so to review these definitions, maybe we can ask the people who were here last week if they might remember. You can try it without notes and see if then, if you can't remember, you can refer to note. But because I think for myself, these working definitions I find so helpful to even memorize, keep them in mind as we talk about self in these weeks. So we talked about a kind of conventional self. If we're saying that this true self of Buddha nature isn't like an ultimately true self, here we're talking about a conventionally true self, a conventionally apparent self, mere I. Do you remember how we talked about this one last week?
I remember because I listened yesterday.
Oh, okay.
One was a series of experiences.
Yeah, that's very close. And we kind of, to flesh out that definition even more, does anyone remember the other parts of the definition?
Causal
series of experiences. And yeah.
And that it's actually useful and necessary to have this conventional sense of conventional
yeah,
self.
It's very useful, yeah. Yeah. And that it's, so this is when we talk about anatman or anatta in Buddhism, we're not talking about this kind of self. We're not refuting this kind of self. We're not saying that this is the problem, this conventional self. So it's a causal series of experiences, and I would add in, I think it's nice to just emphasize, body and mind experiences. Body and mind is, I think, a nice shorthand for five aggregates, for five skandhas. Remember, five skandhas are form, which we could also call body, bodily experience of, including the physical sense faculties. That's how the Buddha actually often defined rupa skanda. Form skanda is eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, like tactile sensation. And also, form includes color, sound, smell, taste, and touches. So it includes, interestingly, the kind of external, so-called external experience of color and sound and so on is part of the form skanda in the early definitions. And then the other skandhas are feelings, perceptions or conceptions. We say formations, you know, which is like karmic tendencies. And consciousness here refers to dualistic consciousness, the way we know objects. So without getting into all the details of that, I like to just say body and mind. All experiences we ever have are experiences of body and mind. And mind, of course, is kind of complex. It's four different skandhas covered, like all our mental experiences. Like in Zen, we talk about, Dogen has an essay called Body and Mind, Study of the Way, and he has this famous phrase, drop off body and mind. You could say, Dogen could have said, drop off the five aggregates, but it's, you know, Zen likes to streamline things. So again, this definition of conventionally appearing self is a call. Actually, there was another little part before the causal series. Do you remember that? Anyone remember this part? I think it's a nice thing to add into this definition. Yeah, convenient. It's a convenient name. Yeah, the self we're talking about here is a convenient name. I think that's a nice twist on this definition, that self or I or person or Kokyo and Corrine and Patrick and these are convenient names. There's like one name for this causal series of body and mind experiences. So there's a lot in this definition. It's a great one, I think, to really, if we memorize that definition, then we can really explore in our own experience all the different elements of it. When we say I, we remember that it's just a convenient name, but there's something about the convenience of having one name, I or self or person, that tends to like make this very complex causal series into some sort of entity. That's how names tend to work, right? You give something a name, a complex, ungraspable something, a name, and it seems to solidify it into a simple thing. Like the chair is also this, you know, is actually a causal series, or maybe for now we could just say it's a collection of parts, like legs and flat surface and screws and things. But as soon as we call it chair, it's very convenient. But that kind of, then we start to feel as if it's some singular entity instead of a bunch of parts put together. So I think this is good to remember.
Would you say the name makes it graspable?
Yeah. Name makes it graspable. Yeah.
For better and worse.
For better, so we can say, is that chair free? It's so convenient, right? That's the better part. And then we start to fall for it, and we think that there's an entity of, graspable entity of chair that's more than just the word. So the Buddhas and ancestors started discovering this thing about language early on, that language tends to reify things. It means make them real. So, the conventionally appearing self, is it just a convenient name, self? But then we say, but what is this name referring to? It's a convenient name for a particular causal series of body and mind experiences. And causal series means that the present body and mind experience is caused by or dependent on the previous moment of body and mind experience. Yes.
Last week you mentioned where you got that phrase.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember.
Oh, I think that something close to this phrase, I think I've tuned it, edited it a bit, but something like this comes from Mark Sideritz, is a modern scholar, who's, I think, really good in kind of taking these complex Buddhist terms, especially Buddhist. He's a philosophy teacher, professor, and he tries to put it in his own sort of modern terms. So this is the classic description of the conventional self, but I think it's a kind of modern description. You wouldn't find that exact phrase in the sutras. And I think it's good because there's nothing extra in this definition. It covers a lot of ground. The conventional self is just a convenient name or designation for a causal series. It means like the chair in terms of time, this chair is a collection of parts based on the previous moment's collection of parts. This chair is impermanent moment to moment. It doesn't look like it's changing, but in the Buddha's teaching, it's like everything is arising and ceasing moment to moment. But it doesn't look like it's changing because the present chair is dependent on the previous chair, which chairs don't move so much. So they look even more permanent. A five aggregates person, actually our five aggregates are quite different a moment ago, right? Our thoughts are different, our feelings are a little different. So it's really pretty easy to see that a person is this causal, constantly changing causal series. And a causal series is a nice way to say it too, because it's not like random. Our present experience of body and mind is not just like out of the blue. It's like completely dependent on the previous moments. So it's very, it has a kind of regularity to it, right? Like, and my sense of this person is a little different from each of your senses of you as a person, because our causal series are different. We have different causal series of body and mind experiences. Of course, we have overlap and we are affecting each other. But our causal series don't get mixed up. I don't suddenly start thinking that I'm Korean or something, right? It's like we have unique, individual causal series, but that's all they are, is causal series. There's not a inherently existent entity of self mixed into the causal series. Yes?
I was going to say, another thing about names is that it sort of implies a certain functionality. Like when you say that that's a chair,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that one looks like a conventional chair, but I was just thinking how art sometimes plays names of things.
Does.
In terms of, there might be something they call chair, they name mm-hmm. it chair, mm-hmm. and you kind of look to, like, why are they assigning chairness to this object or this picture or whatever. So it just, that functionality.
Yeah.
Assigned to names.
I guess it's like the Dadaist movement of art, particularly our Marcel Duchamp, mm-hmm. right, is kind of like, he was really onto something about this naming. For what, maybe one of his most famous paintings is a painting of a pipe, right? A pipe, smoke, and it says under it, yeah, this is not a pipe. So I think he's, that's, and then that kind of messes with our mind, like, what do you mean? It's a pipe, right?
It's a
painting. What?
It's a painting.
It's a painting, yeah. It's not even really a pipe. Of course, it's a painting. So there's various layers of dharma in that painting. Yeah. Yes?
When you said it's not random, what about events? Because those are quite random. Something can happen to somebody. Something can happen to a person.
Well, in according to Buddhist teaching, as I understand, random means like there were no conditions for it, like unconditioned or something. That's how I think of random. So strictly speaking, there's no such thing really as random in the Buddha's teaching. It's more like things that happen seem like out of the blue, and like, how did that happen? There are conditions for them. It's just that we don't see the conditions. What we call random is like, how did that happen? That seems so random. That seems like out of the blue, like suddenly, a rock falls off a mountain and lands on our head right when we're walking under it, right? That's random, but actually, there were a bunch of conditions that happened there. I had to be walking at this right time under it. The rock didn't spontaneously fall. Some condition moved the rock. You know, scientists would agree, right? That there's a condition for everything. It's just that we don't know them. So we say, that was spontaneous or random.
It wasn't causal based on your series of events.
Oh,
like the rock hit Liz or I.
Yeah, so the causal series of body-mind experiences is dependent on, as I'm saying, the previous moment of body and mind experience, but also it's dependent on all these other conditions, like rocks falling, and each other. So our causal series are interdependent with everything, really. We have a unique individual causal series, that's just to say that there's some regularity in these five aggregates that keeps appearing in this pattern. You could say the pattern of these five aggregates has a lot of regularity to it, even though that regularity is constantly interacting with other causal series of aggregates. And the world of rocks falling and things. Yeah.
In physics, there are events that are truly random, unpredictable. Mm. Radioactive decay.
So maybe there's some things like this, unusual things, and maybe a physicist might eventually say, "Oh, we never knew, but now we finally discovered the condition for radioactive decay." I don't know.
No, I mean, it's been proven.
Okay, so maybe there's some things like this, but we're just talking about our causal series of body and mind experiences. And that, I think we can say, is everything in our experience is conditioned in this realm of the conventional self. Yeah.
So getting hit by a rock is actually dependent upon you being in that place mm-hmm. where the rock fell.
Yeah.
But there's no meaning to that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So meaning would be like kind of an extra thing. Yeah. Which is, if I remember, well, maybe just right now, where we're on the topic of meaning, I think it's interesting. It's a little aside, but this is an idea, maybe of Mark Sideritz, this Buddhist scholar, because I haven't heard this in the Buddhist teaching. But he talks about how this sense of being an individual person creates meaning, and maybe here we're talking a little bit more about the second type of self, is this the illusion of a real separate person, like with its own singular identity, and that is part of what we use to create meaning for myself, and that without the sense of a separate self, it's like there's no meaning. It's like there's still a causal series happening, but there's it has no meaning, actually. It's just a bunch of causes and conditions unfolding according to conditions. But this meaning-making faculty of humans I think it's a particular human thing. I don't think that other animals have it. Maybe a little bit, but the animals that hang out with humans a lot maybe start getting a little bit of meaning. But humans are really into having a meaningful life, but it's kind of an illusion. I think it's something interesting to explore. And we might think that then if we let go of the illusion of the separate independent self, we would lose meaning in our life. And according to this teacher Sideritz, he's like, that's right. But some people might say, but that would be really depressing to not have any meaning in our life. But I think the beautiful twist he puts on it is, it would only be depressing for this separate self that is into this issue of meaning or not meaning. You know, can you follow that? So it's like, me who is really into having a meaningful life for myself, I would feel really depressed if I suddenly felt like my life has no meaning. It's just a somewhat arbitrary unfolding of conditions playing out. That would be depressing for me, the separate self. But if we really let go of this illusion of the separate self completely, there wouldn't really be the kind of meaning that we usually think of, but also that wouldn't be a problem. It would just be life happening. And it would be present moment life happening, beautiful and wonderful, but it wouldn't be a good thing or a bad thing that there was no meaning.
But would there be structure?
Structure? Well, there'd be the causal series. That's kind of a structure. There'd be a unique causal series of body and mind experiences continue to play out.
Which we would necessarily fear could not be aware of all these ever together.
It might function almost the way it does right now. Like part of like the way we interact with things, like I think you could have a causal series like that that's like, there's a feeling of hunger now. I think I'll have some food. And like, I'm tired. I'll take a rest. But there's no extra meaning in addition to all that. It's just life playing itself out. And sometimes it kind of sounds like the Buddhas are maybe living that way. They're just responding to conditions. They're not kind of stepping back and saying, how's my life going? Like, am I doing good enough as a Buddha? And is this a meaningful enough life, you know? Yes, Ned.
My feeling is that we can, in a conventional sense, create meaning, but as long as we kind of get that's all it is, that we're creating it, like the Bodhisattva vow is a really good example.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we just take that vow, we function from that, and then we can say, I'm being meaningful in my life because I'm helping relieve suffering. As long as we don't get attached to it.
That's a nice point. That's right. Just like the causal series can be very useful and helpful, and we should not try to, you know, unravel the, you know, refute this conventional self as a causal series. I think that's true, that conventional meaning can really be a really important part of our life, as long as we don't grasp it as a kind of like property of an independent self. And therefore, if anything starts to deviate from the meaningfulness of my trajectory, then it's going to be really painful. That would be how sometimes we grasp meaning and we suffer because we grasp meaning too much. So yeah, we can hold everything lightly and use it. Yeah. Yes. Oh yes. Good one.
Maybe they thought their life was meaningful, but I can't relate to it.
Yes.
Some kind of meaning in contemporary perception of time.
Yes.
But then when you go back thousands of years, people probably have meaningful lives.
Of course.
I can't relate to it so much.
It puts it in perspective, yeah, how we get so into our own causal series. Naturally we do, right? It's because that's always happening here, that we get really into that meaning, but then it's good to remember that perspective of our little lifespan is this tiny blip in the expanse of humanity and life on earth. And and all the great meaning we attribute to our own life is this tiny little flash, right? So yeah, just that perspective is a good one, I think. It's not that we then say it doesn't matter, that's going too far the other way. It's just like we just live our life with this great appreciation of the mystery of it all and not hold any of it too, grasp it too tightly. Yes?
I just wanted to add the word purpose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Meaning has more value, it's subjective, your meaning, you know. But you can have a purpose which is just to get through the day mindfully.
Yeah. Or the Bodhisattva vows. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I think when this person's pointing out this implication of no separate self being no meaning, I think he's talking more about the idea of meaning rather than the purpose. I think a causal series could still even feel like it has a purpose, you know, even to eat the next meal or something. But the meaning is this particularly human thing, that the more sense of an individual entity I feel myself to be, the more I'm into this idea of meaning. Honestly.
I'm kind of curious about something you said earlier, which was, I don't confuse myself with Connie.
Yeah.
And that sense of self, and, you know, you've been in a long-term relationship, sometimes you actually confuse your memories of something you did, and then find out that it actually was a partner, and like you lose that sense of boundary between yourself and your partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you take that lesson and sort of apply it to our conventional self, Corinne's presence here, my presence here, is part of your experience as Kokyo teacher. So where is, you know, maybe it's a functional line that we're drawing?
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
I think so. It's not such a strict line. Yeah, I think you're right. It's a functional line. Because we're all interdependent. Our causal series are all totally affecting each other right now as we speak and listen, and we're changing each other, we're permeating each other even, and in a really long, close, intimate relationship, that's even more the case. It can start to mix together in some way, but I would say you never completely, for an extended time, really start thinking you're the other person, unless you're like schizophrenic or something. I think you still, there's, I just think the interdependence becomes more and more interdependent, but you can still always, even though those people we're the closest to, sometimes then we have a fight, which means like we're really separate, causal series at that moment. We can pull back into it. So I think it's good to remember though that we're so interdependent. While we maintain some uniqueness of a causal series, permeable.
That's kind of where meaning then can arise in the sense of what Nettie was saying, acting out of some responsibility or compassion for other people. Because if we don't have a sense of interdependence, then we have an excuse to behave poorly.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. To provide some meaning to independence.
Yeah, I think that's right, that meaning is almost always associated with some relationality with others. If someone's stranded on a desert island, they know they'll never see any other humans or living beings the rest of their life, and in that thought experiment, we could see they might not get into this issue of meaning so much. They might be more, natural to just like, I just eat a coconut when I need one. But I think it's in relationship to others and society and the world, exactly. That's where we're, in that interdependent realm is where we like to create meaning. Yeah, that's true. So this is all, playing with implications of this definition of the conventional appearing self. Remember the definition now? It's a
convenient name.
experience.
Theories of body-mind experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said, didn't you say there was a third thing?
Third part of the definition. Three selves. This is all, so far we've just been talking about one self. But you could say there's three aspects of this definition. One is that it's a convenient name. One is that it's referring to a causal series. And one is that the causal series is body and mind experiences. And we might even say, if we have to summarize this conventional self definition into one word, let's say, because this would be interesting to compare the three types of self. In one word, let's just call it experience. This present experience, which is, you know, has to do with a name, and it has to do with this experience is arising. Of course, it's body and mind, but it's arising dependent on previous. But experience, our basic experience, is like a kind of our conventional self. Okay, so that's one type of self. The second was the false self, the completely illusory self. So this one we've been talking about is conventionally true, means it's like, the Buddha talks about conventional truth. It's true, in our way of talking in the world, it's a functional truth. We sometimes call it relative truth. Whereas there's another type of self that's not true at all. That's like a completely false, completely an illusion. And this is the kind of the problematic one in the Buddha's teaching. This, when we talk about anatman, where the Buddha's trying, let's understand this illusion and refute it. Means like, let's see how it, come to see how it doesn't exist. And this one we defined last week too. Does anyone remember? It does cause suffering, yeah.
Independent, permanent, unitary.
Yeah, yeah. It's the illusion that there's some independent, singular, that's unitary,
independent.
What's that?
Unchanging.
Yeah.
Permanent.
Yeah. Permanent, independent, and singular. And separate, exactly. The traditional Buddhist definition is singular, permanent, independent. But I like to add in this one of separate, which is not, I think, really fully covered. Maybe it's covered in independent. But actually, I think the reason I like to add in this fourth quality of separate is because this true self that the sutra is going to bring out is also talked about as permanent and kind of like independent in a way and singular. All those come up for this true self. So to distinguish between them, this true self is not a separate individual entity. So I think for the sake of this Buddha nature discussion in this sutra, I think it's nice to add in this fourth quality of the illusory false self. It's also the fact that it's kind of an entity. This true self we're going to get to later is not some sort of graspable type of entity with a location or individual. It is the illusion that the false self here is the illusion of a permanent, singular, independent, separate entity that we call me. And we could say that is the like owner of the causal series. Or we could also put it as the experiencer of the causal series. Or the like the manager, the controller of the causal series. Or another way to put the definition is, to tie the two types of self together, is it's the illusion that the causal series of body and mind experiences is an independent, singular, permanent entity. Can you follow that one? It's the illusion that this causal series, which is just nothing but a like ungraspable flow of arising and ceasing interdependent qualities or experiences of body and mind, it's the illusion that this ungraspable, impermanent multiplicity of body and mind experiences is actually not that, but it's but that the causal series is a singular, independent, permanent entity of self. See, these definitions are like slightly different. They point at slightly different angles, but I think they all hold up quite nicely, partly because this illusion of separate self is not some real thing. So it kind of appears in our experience in slightly different ways at different times. Sometimes we feel that it's like, yeah, this causal series, this ungraspable causal series, somehow really is not just a causal series. It actually is some sort of permanent singular entity. We feel that way. When we stop to look at it, we're like, that doesn't make sense. How could this constantly changing causal series be some singular, permanent, independent entity? Of course it's not, but we often feel as if it is. We try to contain this flow into some packaged thing, partly by conveniently naming it myself.
I think this is a really great way of talking about ego, because people have, we have difficulty talking about ego sometimes in Zen. Some people say it's good, it's important to have, others say no, we have to dissolve it. But this way we can say, yes, we need the ego in the conventional causal series.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't need is the identification, the problem self.
Yeah.
If you're bound.
Mm-hmm. That's only when ego becomes a problem when you're identified with the causal series.
Yep, yep.
So I found this really helpful since last week.
That's another nice word that you mentioned too, is identify with the causal series as myself being some singular permanent entity. Yeah, so I think the word ego really just means self, I think. So I think that ego could apply to either one of these. We could say the conventional ego or the illusory false ego. So I think the third type of true self of Buddha nature, I probably wouldn't use the term ego, but, yeah.
And I think that that's why sometimes people have disagreements with each other when they're talking about ego, because one is the conventional, healthy self-type ego, and the other is thinking that the false, identifying ego, and then the conversation gets...
Exactly.
So this is, I think, a really wonderful way to engage in those conversations by using this language.
Yes, really clarify the difference between these two. Is anyone not clear about seeing the difference between these two types of self? The conventional appearing self, that's a healthy thing. It's not only not a problem, it's extremely beneficial. If we didn't have this sense of being a particular causal series, as I mentioned last week, we'd have no reason to brush our teeth to take care of the future teeth. If we didn't see ourself conventionally as a causal series, causal series involves a future where there's going to be tooth decay if we don't brush them now. It's very helpful to think of like a future of this causal series without getting obsessed about the thing. So then we take care of it. We brush our teeth. But you could say mixing in the other type of self, then we take good care of our teeth, and then next year we do get a cavity anyway. And then if we think, I can't believe it, I did everything to take care of this, and I still got a cavity. It's like, I'm so bad at brushing my teeth. I'm such a failure at tooth care. Then we're like, now we see it, we're mixing in this unhelpful one. It's more like, we just take care of the causal series, it sometimes gets a cavity anyway, and then it's okay, because we're not in control. We're not the controller of the causal series. If we start thinking we're the controller, so there should never be tooth decay, then we're flipping over to this other type of illusory self. So if the conventional self is not a problem and it's quite beneficial, this false self according to the Buddhist teaching, is always a problem. We don't need it to be a person. And it's just problematic. It's even the root, it's sometimes said, of all discontent. And these are like kind of big statements. So, yes.
I agree with all of this 100%. And I also notice, as a person trained to be a life coach, that in psychology circles and self-improvement, many spiritual circles, the exact opposite is presented to people as important teachings for them to take on and embrace and embody in order to control the circumstances of their lives and direct things in a more positive way that they are responsible for.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you're right. That, again, they can get mixed together, and maybe a good, because you could say, what about the bodhisattva vows and the precepts? Is that kind of controlling the flow? So I think as long as we remember, like Neti's saying, if all these practices, conventional, we call them conventional Buddhist practices of like, you know, receiving the precepts and trying to live this way, if we take them, hold them not too grasping away, like, I failed again with that precept. Like, we just like, no, it's just training the causal series, we could say. I'm taking on the bodhisattva precepts to kind of like train the causal series into a really beneficial one. And therefore, I'll make a great effort at it, but if there's failure along the way, it's okay, because really nobody's really in control of it. It's just, if anyone's in control, you could just say the Buddha is, because he gave us this teaching. And we just receive it from him, and like, okay. And then we pass it on to others like that. And so you could say the Buddha started it going. But
you can see how this would really be a difficult thing to communicate in those circles in any helpful way. Because if you're telling somebody, yes, you have agency on one end, on the other end, you really don't. So you can make some efforts, but don't be attached to actually accomplishing anything that you're intending.
Yeah. Yeah, but in these circles, we can talk that way.
Yes. Fortunately, we're in these circles, right?
Yes, Yara.
I was going to say, but and some Christian saints, they feel that they are not the controller, that they are being kind of lived by God.
Yeah.
And so they're just, it's sort of being a form of agency. It's like being a vessel or a tool.
Thy will be done.
Greater power.
Yeah. So, and you could say that's even like a practice of surrendering the separate controller self. I think that might be some equivalent in that tradition of a practice for, I surrender my separate identity of the singular individual one to God's will, and then but not the causal series. Of course, that's going to keep playing out, but yeah, that separate one, you could say that's a method. And maybe the Buddha's method is more like, let's discern in meditation, when we get really quiet and still, try to discern the sense of the separate self so that we can kind of deconstruct it or unravel it. In a way, to actually see it is to deconstruct it. It's not like there's another step. To really understand what we're talking about here in a deep way, over and over again, to keep remembering, oh, here's the causal series is now solidifying into this separate controller of experience. And I see that's the false one. And just like the Buddha say, there's suffering here with this controller, even experiencer, which might say, what's such a problem about being an experiencer rather than just being experience? And you could say the experiencer, if there's a really painful experience, then the experiencer will be the sufferer, right? Well, sometimes when it's pleasant, it will be I will be the enjoyer. But sometimes I will be the sufferer, which is, I think, much worse than just suffering happening. To be the sufferer is really...
Or the Atman. The conventional self is experiencing.
Yes, and exactly.
The Anatman would be more like the experiencer.
Well, we're not going to call the Anatman means the not self. So when Buddha talks about Anatman, he means it's not this self. It's not the experiencer.
Okay, so Anatman is not the false self.
That's right. Anatman is the refutation of the false self. It means, so you could say it like, that's right, that the conventional self is experience, the false self is the experiencer, and the Anatman, or the not self, would be the non-experiencer in the midst of experience. That there's not an experiencer in the midst of experience. The experiencer here is the Atman of Anatman. Follow that? Yeah.
Even though you haven't said it yet, it seems like if we see ourselves as a causal stream, then we'll see others as a causal stream.
Yes. Yes.
And if we identify with that causal stream in ourselves in a problematic way, we also identify it with them in the same way.
Yes.
And so we amplify the problem enormously.
Yeah. Yeah.
They
always do. Yep. Yep. So the more we see it, and yeah, no, interesting, in the Buddha's really early sutra definition, I can just read this. He talks about this internal and external self, so we are applying it to other people too. This is what I was talking about last week, that supposedly the second teaching the Buddha ever gave in the Deer Park at Usipatthana near Varanasi, after he set in motion the wheel of Dharma, maybe the next day, the next Wednesday night, he gave this talk. It was all about not self. And one centerpiece of it is thus, monks, any form, he's talking about the five skandhas, the five aggregates, any form, or this translation even says body, any body whatsoever that's past, present, or future, internal or external, I think that means this causal series or that causal series, that body, blatant or subtle, some subtle body, common or sublime, far or near, each body or each form is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment as, quote, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. And then he goes through each of the five skandhas. Any feeling whatsoever, internal or external, somebody else's feeling, and my own feeling, subtle or gross, whatever, is to be seen as it actually is, with right discernment, as this is not mine, this feeling is not mine. It's kind of like hard to maybe accept that this body is not mine. These feelings are not mine. These thoughts are not mine. It kind of goes along with, they're not myself. In fact, they're two different meditations. One is to say, this body is not myself. Another meditation is, this body is not, doesn't belong to myself. Like there's not some entity of self that owns the body. This is not what I am. This dualistic consciousness, external or internal, right? Subtler, common, subtler or blatant, common or sublime, far or near. Each dualistic consciousness is to be seen as it actually is, with right discernment. This is not mine. This is not myself. This is not what I am. And then the Buddha goes on, seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones grows disenchanted with the five aggregates. With bodies, feelings, thoughts, perceptions, their karmic patterns, their dualistic consciousness, they become disillusioned. I think disenchantment and disillusion are nice words, because we often are enchanted with the five skandhas as ourself, but they're fine, they're nice, they're our life, right? But we become disenchanted, just like disillusioned, And with this disenchantment and disillusion with the body and mind as myself, this noble disciple is fully released or liberated. And with full liberation, there is the knowing. There is total liberation here. So that's an early sutra. Yes.
Noticing in the conversation we're talking about the emptiness of self, not just emptiness of self, but emptiness of other. And there are certain schools of Buddhism that emphasize that. And when we talk about I just lost my time. There's so much in what you just said. I'm seeing if any of it can.
I don't know if you're talking about the Tibetan Shentong, Rongtong.
Rongtong, sure. I mean, that was in the background, but...
Which means, self-empty and other-empty is, I think, it's a little different than this conversation because it's not about the personal self. I'd say that's more like self there means like empty of itself rather than empty of a personal self. So slightly different direction.
That's helpful. Mm-hmm. And also, when we look at, we were talking a little bit about psychological theories or psychological insights and how sometimes those are used to actually reify the self that we're actually seeing through from this perspective. And it's kind of assumptions and what we're calling kind of false self or what, all these kinds of built up assumptions and samskaras. It's my experience. I can see that from the perspective of this teaching, but when I see it practically, like personally and also in community of people, not just Buddhist community, but community, you know, any community and socially, these teachings and practices can be so helpful in loosening up some of our rigidities and attachments for outcome or identity. And yet at the same time, we can also use them to discredit the feelings and emotions that are actually arising as they appear. Even if they're just appearance, they're appearing vividly, and there they are. And when we choose to investigate them and receive them fully, it seems to me that they do loosen up. But that process of looking at them, investigating them fully, if we're discrediting them, we don't even give that chance. And sometimes, and this may be just my opinion, I think actually some of our Western psychological traditions are better at doing that than Buddhism is.
Mm. Yeah, so there's some good points here that I think, for one, is that even though we're talking about how it's helpful to see other people as causal series, I think that's true. But in the case where, say, another person is really suffering, and in parentheses, in Buddhism, suffering means, is always based on this grasping the separate self, actually. So we kind of, we don't just say, oh, they're grasping a separate self and they don't need to. Well, for the others, we actually take care of it. We're just like, how can I help you? We almost relate to them as a separate self, at least until they feel supported and taken care of. And then if they're a Dharma practitioner, then we might be able to, especially after the suffering cools down, we might be able to then talk about these kind of things. But really, I think these kind of deeper teachings of anatman, like the not-self, it's pretty deep teaching, actually. I think they're really for ourselves as practitioners to investigate, and maybe to investigate first when we're not suffering too terribly. when we're doing okay and little things annoy us. Oh, there it is. There's the sense of the reified, separate experiencer or controller. I feel as if there's something in addition to the ungraspable, impermanent flow of the causal series. We can sometimes catch it But we should also have compassion for ourselves. If we're really in a lot of pain, sometimes we try to bring up a teaching like that to ourselves, and it's like, I don't even want to hear it. I just need some comfort, right? So I think that's valid. We should take care of our, we can bring compassion to this body and mind, first. Always start with that. I think always start there. And then sometimes we feel supported by that. We're a little settled. And then, you know, outside of such a practice and a teaching, we might be like, that's good enough. Now I'm just, at least now I'm settled and I feel supported. I feel like my solid sense of content self is back. So now I can carry on. But here we might be like, wait a second. There's this pattern that keeps playing out. I keep feel like things are going along and then something triggers this grasping, capacity of the mind. Like, what is that there? Sometimes we can apply the teaching right in the midst of, if we're courageous enough to do it, right when we're feeling the contracted illusion of the separate self, we're like, we can try to, and the more we consider and think about these teachings, the more they'll pop in at that time, like, oh, wait a second, what am I doing here? So we can hear these things once a week, and then they're probably not going to come in at that time, but if we consider them through the week, if we bring them up in meditation, then maybe they pop up just when we need them, and in smaller situations. So, like that. Yes, Sandra.
When you use the phrase training the causal series,
yeah.
I don't know how to conceptualize that without there being a
trainer. Yeah, a trainer, right?
Yeah.
So you're right, there's no trainer. There's no trainer of the causal series, but I think there can be training. It's just that there's no trainer doing it. That's why I said, if we say there's a trainer, we can call it the Buddha, because he's giving these teachings, right? And like, what's the Buddha is inconceivable. But these teachings have come from awakened awareness, and we hear them, and then now we're at part of the conditioning. Do we need a controller to hear them and put them into effect? No, maybe just they come into our ears, and then that teaching is now like percolating in our body and mind, and the training is happening now, right? Yeah, so you could say Dharma is the training of the causal series, but yeah. And then we can easily bring in a trainer. But that's where a nice thing is to not make a separate self around practicing no separate self, right? let's just let the training happen without there being a trainer, which is hard to do. The more we get into it, the more we feel like, this is great, let's really do it, and let's keep doing it, and like, how am I doing it? And I was doing good enough, and like, oh, wait a second, we've gone too far. Let's just let the teachings circulate through our body and mind. They'll naturally train us. Yes.
That's how I think the shame can be so helpful, because
yeah.
You just agree to practice wholeheartedly, and then you step away, and a few days later it's like, oh, it feels so crass to move too fast or to not sit down and give thanks for the food and take care. It's like, oh,
Yes, it's a good example too of how, yeah, and then after that week, the dominant conditioning tends to kick back in, and all the conditioning of society, the fast-paced culture, so this is a lifelong practice. There's no end.
Yet there are people, as Russ's point, going back to Russ's point, there are people who really need assistance and need help. And so it might be helpful to overemphasize agency. People who've had severe lack of agency.
Yeah, that's right.
But that the teaching could be, oh, well, you can influence things. You can influence causes and conditions. Every action, I think, has a reaction.
Yeah.
But not get attached to the outcome.
Influence, that's a good word.
Mm-hmm. Because if I get attached, if I see that, if I expect a certain outcome and it doesn't happen, that's where the suffering occurs.
Yeah, because that's where we're starting to solidify a separate self over here and over there. That's what gets into expectations and results, right?
But we can't influence
change. Mm-hmm.
Because our actions are
bad. Yeah, yeah. And really, most of these teachings are, I know the Bodhisattva path is so much about helping others, but the whole tradition is generally keeps pointing back towards the way we do that is to take care of our own false view. I think these are like, yeah, this is great. Let's like try to tell everybody else how they don't really have this separate self. It's like, no. We always are applying it to ourselves, and the more we start seeing through it, the more people don't even have to hear anything about Buddha or Buddha's Dharma, but if we're more free of our own suffering, because we're more free of our own grasped separate self, the more we're just naturally available to help others in all kinds of just normal, conventional ways. So it's like it's kind of an internal training with the understanding and trust that really will just take care of all our relationships better and better. Yeah, and community. So it's kind of this and Zen is beautiful because we have this internal Zazen practice as the kind of basis of our community, that we're mostly doing this kind of internal work of, we could say Zazen could be understood as like letting go of this illusion of the separate self. That's one way of looking at Zazen. And then we turn away from the wall and get up and do things together too, based on that. So yeah, back and forth. Yes.
I'm wondering how to apply this teaching. What's missing is, once you notice, oh, okay, I'm reacting as if I have this separate self.
Mm-hmm.
It's the true self teaching. That's the next step.
That's going to be one of them, yeah.
That's the shift.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But this true self, which we haven't really gotten into, and maybe won't today yet because we have four more classes, and I thought we'll spend the first two on these conventional self and the false self before we get into the true. Because the Buddha points this out also in the sutra. He talks about all three, actually. And so, even in all these early sutras that don't talk about true self, this true self teaching is one of the radical points of this sutra and of Zen. But early Buddhism, they don't ever talk about the true self. So in a way, you don't really need it for practicing. And the way you could do it, from just talking about the first two, the way you practice is you just acknowledge and accept and honor the causal series conventional self and take care of your teeth and so on. And then, but really the practice in early Buddhism is to really examine closely over and over again this sense of the illusory experiencer and how it's really, we can't find an experiencer. If you feel like you're an experiencer, it has a lot to do with consciousness, right? That fifth aggregate is an arising and ceasing knowing of objects, but that's not an experiencer, that's just an experience. An experience I would define here as always like dualistic. I think it's part of the important definition that will make the whole system work when we hear about the true self of non-dual experiencing. Then it helps to look at anything that's happening in consciousness. Vijnana, the fifth aggregate, is by definition dualistic. It means it's like there's always a sense of a subject and an object. And while we're on the topic of subject and object, another contemporary Buddhist scholar, a woman named Miri Al-Bahari, I think has this great teaching. She's got a book called Analytical Buddhism, and maybe some articles too. this is kind of a unique discussion about the separate self here. Her unique understanding here is that she makes this crucial distinction between the self, and what here we're talking about the false illusion of self, and the subject, when she's talking about anatman. So sometimes we might think of this false self is the sense of being a subject of experience, right? So I think she's makes a nice distinction here between the separate self and the subject of experience. And so what she says is that the self is an illusion to be deconstructed, but the subject, the sense of subjectivity, is conventionally true, conventionally real, as the capacity to observe, to know, to witness, to be consciously aware. Now, and we're not talking about non-dual awareness here, or like Buddha nature. We're just talking about the sense of subjectivity as like feeling that I'm like a witness of experience. She's saying that's kind of like a conventional self, this subjectivity, and it's fine. It's not the culprit of the separate self. This witnessing, or witnessing consciousness, she says, means that there is something it is like to be apprehending the world. And in kind of Western studies of the self, this phrase comes up a lot. This something it is like is... I've been trying to meditate on this and see what you think with it. Like, I think the original one who came up with the phrase was talking about some other animal and saying that this sense of subjectivity or self is like to be a bird. There is something it is like to be a bird. We can assume, we don't know what that is like, but we can assume that there is something it is like to be a bird.
In a sense that it's shared among all birds?
No, I don't think it's like that. I think it's more like there's a sense of being an individual, like consciousness. Just like a person. Like there is something it is like to be Kokyo. It's hard to define what that is. That's why it's a weird phrase. But there is something it is like to be Kokyo. And when I wake up tomorrow morning, after not being Kokyo all night, I open my eyes and I'm like, yeah, this is familiar. There's something it's like to be me. And there's something it's like to be you. And there's something it's like to be a dog and a bird and a cat and a mouse, right? This something it is likeness is one way of that Western tradition, kind of modern Western phenomenology or self-studies, talks about the self. Yeah. So here she's saying this something it is likeness is a kind of this witnessing of the world is subjectivity. There's something it is like to be apprehending or to be undergoing apprehension of the world. This includes all kinds of conscious experiencing, perceiving, thinking, introspecting, both attentive and inattentive, like when we're just totally spaced out and distracted. It's still something it is like to be distracted, right? Human and non-human. So that's like subjectivity is like this something it is likeness. A little bit like I would say what we're talking about, the conventional self. But then this false self in the Buddha's teaching is the mistaken assumption that the subject is a self, is a fixed separate individual. So I think this is a nice way of modern person investigating experience making a distinction between subjectivity and the fixed, separate, independent self. So she goes on that this illusion is based on the subject being identified with the aggregates of body and mind. Right? That the kind of sense of what it is likeness or witnessing consciousness it starts to get identified with like the body, like I actually am the body. She says, "It's if I."
With the experience.
Yeah, experience of the body. Mm-hmm, yep. If I identify with the body, it is as if the subject becomes fused with the body, if I identify with the mind, I think here we're talking about dualistic consciousness, the subject is identified as being more than a mere witness, the subject, but as being a bounded entity that endures over time, which seeks happiness and avoids suffering, a personal owner and controlling agent, unified and unconstructed or unconditioned. So, yeah, I like this, that distinction between subject and self. And also we're saying subject as a kind of the sense of witnessing presence, as a kind of witnessing consciousness of subjectivity, is starting to go in the direction of the true self, of Buddha nature. But actually, it's not quite, because Buddha nature is not like subjectivity. It's like all-inclusive awareness without subjects and objects. So it goes a step further than this, than the kind of witnessing consciousness. Yes?
Kind of circling back, but it's also kind of part of this. I was thinking about the sort of Western psychological approaches often. Traumas to the ego seem to, a lot of them, the roots in childhood. And I was thinking about childhood and how that's, you're going through this developmental thing from a conventional standpoint of individuating.
Yeah.
And there's sort of this very dependent and helpless self.
Conventional self.
On others.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the conventional self.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying that this, it seems like that's the root of many people's, you know, identity crises or just traumas, neuroses, whatever. And so it's kind of, and sometimes as an adult, when you kind of have wisdom, you know, a wisdom teaching kind of come in and intersect with that stuff, you can kind of look back and sort of, you know, see that being that was you, yourself, you know, and have kind of compassion for it as this sort of dependent, seemingly dependent, you know, body.
Well, it's the causal series, really.
Yeah, this causal series did have some kind of thing happen.
Yeah. And then memory is a big part of the causal series. It's sometimes the fourth skanda is particularly connected with memory. In fact, Red Pine, contemporary translator, translates the fourth skanda of formations, we say. He translates that as memory. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I think it's one, it's only part of it, yeah. But memory is a huge part of what's needed to construct the illusion of a separate identity, of separate self. Trauma happens to the causal series. Some painful experience happens in this causal series of experiences. And then years and years later, it's still functioning in that causal series. So I think you're right. And then the wisdom teachings can both have compassion for that and also say, yes, that all happened. It was extremely painful to this causal series. But there's no, but this causal series now is, though it's based on that one, it doesn't have to identify with that experience from 50 years ago as like my true self. Yeah, it can be more, we don't deny it, but we don't have to hold it so tightly. That's just part of the causal series. Like every causal series is going to be bombarded by both pain and pleasure throughout its evolution as a causal series. And to not like fixate on any like particular part of it, but to let it keep flowing and arising and ceasing. We tend to, Buddha teaches that way too, sometimes of these five aggregates of experience of body and mind, we sometimes fixate on one more than the other. Like if the body is in great pain, well, our whole identity seems fused with the body. I think she said fused with the body, right? Like we feel as if, like if the, some part of the body is in great pain, it's more like, that's who I am. There's no other thought even possible to happen here. I'm just like totally this pain. But sometimes the body's quite comfortable, but there's, say, like a memory is, say, really painful. I think particularly when anything's really painful or really pleasurable, it kind of like we then identify, we kind of fixate on that. That, because the experience is so strong, we start to fixate on that experience as ourself. And but it's only just part of the whole flow of five aggregates.
Where do instincts and the survival instinct fit in with this, that kind of non-conscious drive?
Yeah. So we might also, people often ask, well, so if we can function fine with this, with just the causal series conventional self, why is it that we have this extra illusion that causes all this suffering and doesn't seem to do much good? And this could be one story of why, of how it, this illusion evolved, is some sort of like survival mechanism, some sort of instinct to maintain the causal series. That it could be that, it could be that for survival of the causal series, the illusion of the false self could be evolutionarily beneficial to, you know. So that could be one story, right? And you could say the gene pool that survived is the most deluded beings. The ones that hold the false view most strongly are the ones that survive over the ones that are just like, well, the causal series comes and goes, whatever, I'm ready to die. That's when that gene pool dies out, right? The ones like, no, I'm going to maintain myself and get away from me. Here we are. So I think, yeah, I think something about that survival instinct might be connected with the illusory self. But I think you could still have the cause, well, I don't know. If you didn't have that at all, like a Buddha who's totally seen through the false illusion of self, is still happy to, hunger arises to feed the body, it's just responding to conditions. Their survival instinct, the survival instinct of a Buddha might be quite low. I'm sort of imagining that, like we hear these Zen stories, right, of like the bandits come to attack the Zen master or something. He's like, okay, go ahead, like, I'm ready to die. It's like low survival instinct.
Well, and the self-immolation, so that kind of tremendous training, so that the very unconscious drive to survive is overridden by this ability to stay present in death.
Yeah. So I think this, of course, these things could go too far if we become kind of careless about the causal series. But that's why I think it's part of the Buddha's middle way teaching. The middle way is free from the extremes of a totally existent, reified, separate self, and free from the other extreme of there's not even any conventional self, and so nothing matters. The middle way is the conventionally dependent arisen self, you could say, is, and taking care of that could be said to be the middle way. So, but we don't become obsessed about it. So when it's time to die, it's okay. But before that, it's like we don't neglect it. So it's not exactly maybe survival instinct, but it's still, it doesn't go too far the other way, and like it doesn't matter, we stop feeding ourselves or something. And therefore that middle way, the Buddha says, is a very like happy way to live, right? It's not like neglect of self-care, but it's just the right amount that's appropriate. And if things don't, because we're not in control of this body and mind, if we take good care of it and it's still, we get sick or whatever, it's like, well, okay, that's the way it should be, because there's lots of other conditions here that I'm not in control of. Yes?
The survival thing? Is it quickly?
Yeah.
Because I had a personal experience where it was just a lot of energy to meet the situation rather than me versus you, or it could be a combative sort of thing, being lost in the Rocky Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened where there's a lot of energy to take care of the situation, and just simply on a basic level perhaps preserve this order. And it wasn't, it actually was equipped with a lot of knowledge of what to do
mm-hmm.
beyond the conditioning that we have that separates us from our survival instincts. So I'm just wondering, I can see how you're saying that, like, the people who survive the most are perhaps the most deluded, or like their genes are preserved because, especially in exploitative structures, those who tend to be the most selfishly motivated tend to aggregate towards the top.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and there's a natural will to live, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, and it seems that there could be a basic wisdom for that. Although, if we have an exclusivity with that drive, that, and we're not seeing through it, like I think you were saying, which I thought was very well put, and maybe I'm summarizing it differently than you did. It's that's where the problem is, and it just need not be a problem. But I don't know. I just the reason why I'm speaking up and addressing this is that maybe this is my hang up, that whenever I feel that from a Buddhist perspective, we almost shoot down something that actually could be quite useful or serve us. I'm like, well, wait a minute. You know, what if there is a wisdom function to that capacity?
Yeah, and maybe the practice perspective would be like, it's probably different for different people that I don't know, what one of those movies I saw about the documentary about the mountain climber who broke a leg, right, and was able to, like, drag himself for miles through the snow and survive. And I thought, like, if I was in that situation, would I have done that? I don't think so. I would have probably been like, I would have, right at the beginning, I might have been like, okay, it's time to go. But, you know, you never know. You never know.
So you don't know until you're in a situation.
Yeah, so you don't know.
I went through the paralytic phase, like, oh my God, I need to get out here, there's mountain lions, to suddenly, like, forget it, I'm surviving, and then just, like, having this calm take over, too, well, whatever happens, and yet I have the end.
Yeah.
I just don't know.
So what I was going to say, from the practice perspective, we could say, well, we just watch what happens. It's more, and different people might respond differently, but it's like, I think we could just watch a very energetic five skandhas thing, like totally go all out to survive without there being some kind of like obsessive kind of thought of like, I have to preserve my separate self. It's more just like great energy, right? So I don't, like, Buddhas aren't really passive creatures, right? They can have their five aggregates, body and mind, can be very dynamic and expressive and creative and determined, right? Great effort and determination. But, and it could happen that way, but the practice perspective might be like, well, we just, oh, that's interesting. There's a lot of energy to survive here. We'll go with it. Let's keep going. Rather than like, I have to figure out how to do that. And it's not my intuition, but like, I have to force. I think the separate self is often has a sense of forcing something beyond what's natural. Whereas that could be a totally natural, unforced, great energetic urge to survive and acting on it. You know what I mean? Like almost like you could have that that witnessing experience of like, this is just, this, there's a lot. This person is making a huge effort. This person. But that's interesting. Yeah. It's more like when we separate from it and like, now I'm the controller of this person and I, as the separate identity, have to take care of this person. Then we might not take care of it as efficiently as if it's like, let's just let the energy of the person do its thing. Something like that. Well, this is a great discussion. You're definitely a lively bunch. I didn't get nearly as far as I thought in this class, but maybe next time we do a few more pieces on this conventional self and separate self, and then move on to the true self. Yeah.
How much did you? I noticed on your most recent email, you said something about you had done some revisions.
Yeah.
The first.
Oh.
Is there a lot of revisions?
Not too much. Not too much. You could keep it.
Well, if there's anything important as you're going through.
Yeah, we'll read it out loud.
That maybe mm-hmm. I'm missing.
Yeah, yeah, the various pieces. I like these study projects, and the sutra is, as I, you know, like 1,000 pages or something. It's huge. So I really made it a project to, looking at a lot of commentaries too, that mention these are the important and unique Buddha nature teachings, especially in the sutra, and to find those places and compile them. So yeah, the handout changed a little bit. And it'll be good to talk about, because some of them are strange, and it actually sounds like the sutra seems to contradict itself all over the place. So it's very dynamic.
When I left the room, was there something about something you wanted to email?
No. You have the current handout. Yeah. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.